clerk to call our second case.
The court will now call number 2251032BR, Barnett versus State. May it please the court, Ms. Ray Tucker will argue for Cohen and Mr. Joshua Llewellyn will argue for the state.
May it please the court. And if your honors don't mind, I'll have my iPad up here so I can sit a little bit.
Would you mind pulling the, yep.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to hear in this big room.
Sometime. Is that better?
I think so.
Okay. I'll speak up. May it please the court. My name is Grace Tucker and I represent appellant Keith Barnett. It is a well and long established principle in this nation that when a court is to evaluate the reasonableness of a search and a seizure, here to evaluate weigh the interest of the nature and the quality of an individual's Fourth Amendment right against the government's interest and the alleged justification of that intrusion. However, it's an issue of first impression in this court, as well as the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals and the Supreme Court, just what exact test or consideration is used when deciding the reasonableness of a delay of a search of an item when that item has already previously been seized.
Well, so interrupt you right now.
Yes, Your Honor.
Before we even get to the question of whether that 129 day delay was, busted the Fourth Amendment, what is the strongest evidence in the record that Mr. Barnett had an actual possessory interest in the DVR that he's challenging that was waited too long to be searched?
Yes, Your Honor. And that goes obviously to the threshold question that a court's required to address before deciding the substantive violation of the Fourth Amendment concern there, which is obviously standing. Here, looking at the trial court record, first we have the district court held a pretrial hearing on the motion to suppress. At that hearing, defendant Mr. Barnett called one witness. It was the lead officer in the case, Officer Lee. And then the state and the defendant made argument. At that time, the district court held that the defendant had not met his burden and hadn't established standing at that point. However, later on throughout trial, Mr. Barnett re-urges.
Just standing is he had to have some type of possessory interest in the DVR and the cell phones, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And the cell phone was taken off of him, so the evidence would show he did have a possessory interest in the cell phone, but the DVR is something that was in the residence itself. So was there any evidence in the original hearing of any possessory interest in that residence and therefore the DVR and the cameras that were recording inside the residence?
Your Honor, we agree with the district court that in that initial pretrial hearing, Mr. Barnett hadn't established standing at that point. However, when he re-urged his motion and the court reconsidered his motion during trial, the court was able to, at that point, consider all the evidence that had been submitted to the court at trial thus far. And at that point, the state's lead investigator in the case, or lead officer in the case, Officer Lee, had testified to several points. And ultimately his position that Mr. Barnett, along with the two co-defendants in this case, had care, custody, and control of every item in that house. Specifically, he acknowledged that Mr. Barnett had possession, not physical possession at that time, he had constructive possession of that DVR.
Just for clarity, because just so to kind of clear up some confusion, you have standing that really pertains to whether or not you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the thing that's to be searched. And then you have these variables that you can consider in determining, you know, at that point, it's really kind of, it's kind of apples and oranges, but they're very similar. There's a blend there, correct? And so then you have this idea of a possessory interest that you have to look at under the case law to determine whether or not the amount of time goes too long, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And so obviously at the very beginning, the trial court was looking at just the issue of standing as it pertains to the Fourth Amendment in general.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
I'm sorry. I misphrased my question earlier, but yes. But counsel understood what I was getting at, fortunately.
I was going to clarify to make sure that was.
Does the trial court have to believe the state's witness if the state's witness says that there was a possessory interest? Can the trial court disbelieve that in looking at all the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. And when looking at the credibility of a witness, that is absolutely in the trial court's right and in their job is to assess the credibility of that witness.
Yeah. Okay. What are we to make, if anything? So I pulled the part of Officer Lee's testimony that you were referring to, where he basically said that Mr. Barnett had a possessory interest. Well, he was possessing the items along with everybody else in the house. But then he was specifically asked about the DVR. So he had a possessory interest in it. And Officer Lee started to say, I would say, and then there was an objection, calls for legal conclusion. And that objection was never ruled on. And Ms. Officer Lee never answered that question. Does that matter to our analysis on the possessory interest?
Your Honor, I don't think it does. But even if it did, I think we can look to the rest of the trial court's record and to kind of gather what Officer Lee was relying on to make that decision, had that been a legal conclusion. He talks about, in addition to his statements, that it's his position that Mr. Barnett had possession of that DVR. There's testimony about, there's questions about why nothing was fingerprinted. And Officer Lee notes that even if things were fingerprinted and Mr. Barnett's fingerprints were not on anything in the house, it would still be his position, given Mr. Barnett's location at the house, that he was in possession of those.
And would guns. The same have been true, I guess, if all three defendants, all three defendants would have had the same level of possessory interest because they were all there?
Your Honor, I believe so. I wasn't trial counsel, and I don't have a full understanding. The record's not fully clear on everyone's kind of specific positions and involved in this case. However, based on what we do have, I do believe that's the case.
The original search warrant was based upon the poll camera. Okay, the poll camera didn't at any point in time reveal that your client was in any way, shape, or form associated with that residence. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, because it was law enforcement that installed the poll camera.
Right. Correct. But the search warrant that ultimately was the basis of the seizure of the DVR was not directed toward the defendant. It was directed toward, I'm assuming, his son, Junior.
Correct.
Okay. And so Junior is actually the target with regard to the search warrant. And at the point, the execution of the search warrant, the first time that law enforcement comes across your client is he's trying to claw himself over the back fence, but they don't find him in the residence. And in fact, the only evidence presented at trial that he was ever in the residence was from the DVR and the surveillance cameras that showed him, arguably, I know there's a dispute about whether it was him, but the jury found it was him in the residence. So at what point in time would you say law enforcement came to understand that your client had a possessory interest in the DVR if nothing up until the point of the motion to suppress indicated that he had a possessory interest in the residence?
Your Honor, I would point the court back to, again, Officer Lee's testimony about his position that, based on their investigation, which, again, is limited in the record, but it seems like much of that investigation happened kind of in that short window of the poll camera and the search itself, that based on that, he believed that Mr. Barnett had a possessory interest. I also think it's important to highlight the district court's kind of analysis on this as well. When addressing the standing issue itself, the district court highlighted that an argument that this, I believe the Crenshaw Avenue residence, which is the residence that we're talking about, even if it wasn't his primary residence, that's not enough of an argument to kind of carry the day on that. Also, and more importantly, the court very much focused on the state's whole argument up until that point, and the record reflects, you know, throughout the rest of the trial, is that Mr. Barnett's ties to that house is what equated the state's, or it was the state's theory on getting possession. And I acknowledge the analysis on possession and standing are different, but I think that's really important. And the court noted that if he didn't have standing here, then the state wasn't able to meet its burden on the possession either.
I have another question about the timeline. So I understand there's this delay between seizing the DVR and getting the search warrant to actually look inside it and see what was on the recordings. But it was a number of months after that before Mr. Barnett filed his motion to suppress. So was he aware at the time the search warrant issued that they were going to be looking at this DVR? And does his own delay come into play as far as weakening his possessory interest? Because I understand from the record, he never, unlike a cell phone that somebody's had seized, you know, and you ask for it back, it's my understanding he never asked for the DVR.
Correct, Your Honor. And yes, that absolutely does weaken his possessory interest. And looking at those five factors that we talk about in our brief, and possessory interest being one of them, or the significance in a significant interference with possessory interest.
And he was in jail for most of the time, so he couldn't possess it even if he wanted to.
Correct, Your Honor.
Let me just humor me for just a second. So obviously, this is a case of first impression. There's some scant case law in this area. And I'm going to just really quick give you an idea of what my view of this jurisprudence is. You know,
be careful.
The you have, you know, not a lot of cases out there because this just is something in the criminal world that nobody ever was concerned about. Law enforcement seizes evidence that's, you know, relative to the case. It's relevant. It could be probative. It could be material, all these things. And so criminal defense attorneys just say, well, they've seized it and there's not a lot we can do about it. But then you get to these cases, these new cases at the U.S. Supreme Court about important devices like phones and tablets and things like that, that necessarily have lots of personal information in them. And you have people saying, I need that access to that device. You can't keep my phone forever. I need that. And so then you have this, all these new cases. You have creative lawyering at some point because you have people complaining about, hey, I need my phone back. So then all of a sudden, these things were being challenged. They make it to the U.S. Supreme Court. U.S. Supreme Court says you can't keep somebody's phone, can't keep their devices, you can't keep them forever. They have a possessory interest in these items. And then, of course, we have situations now where the jurisprudence could potentially expand because of some creative lawyering. It's like, hey, wait a second. Now we know that these devices can't be held in perpetuity, and there's got to be some kind of time that's reasonable in order to search them. And with that being said, I mean, this is essentially cameras that are inside a house, okay? And normal people don't have cameras inside their house. Would you agree with that? I mean, that's just not a normal thing.
Yes, Your Honor, I would. I think there's a change in that with different, for example, when I was babysitting in college, a lot of families did have cameras, I think, nowadays in their house. But as a general principle, yes.
Right. And I mean, if you don't have infants in the house and babysitters in the house, it's not necessarily a normal thing to have cameras in your house, unless it's some kind of weird exception, some kind of perverted reason, or some kind of child protection reason.
The Jeffrey Epstein exception.
That's just a normal thing. You would agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so it's interesting. You have these U.S. Supreme Court cases, and then the state actually, and I don't know if you saw their, I guess you could call it a letter brief or an amendment, or, you know, you have these cases that are saying you can't do that. But then the Eighth Circuit recently says, hey, look, even if we've taken a telephone and that phone is just by possessing it in and of itself is incriminating, not irrespective of what the contents are, but just the possession of the phone. Maybe you have six burner phones, right? That by itself may be evidence that this guy's a drug dealer if he's carrying six phones. Do you agree with that? And the point is just by virtue of it being in their possession, that is an indication of criminality, that then you don't even have to go and look at all these variables, and you don't even really have to do a balancing test at that point, because the state has a right to keep it, at least until the case is disposed. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree in terms of, yes, that is what the Eighth Circuit has recently held. I do think that this case is different. I don't think that the record, I believe it was 6 or 7 phones in that case. And I think the facts in this case are different. The record reflects reliance on the physical DVR in order to show criminality.
Well, the officer did say, essentially, that a lot of drug dealers who have drug houses or trap houses, if you want to call them that, will have this kind of infrastructure inside them, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And if we followed the Eighth Circuit, essentially, and just said, look, you know, people who have cameras in their house, maybe if we consider other variables too, you know, it's just that's evidence of criminality by itself, then you would have a problem, wouldn't you, at that point? You agree that if we decided like the Eighth Circuit did, that we could theoretically say, look, just by virtue of having this kind of technology in your home is some evidence of being a drug dealer.
Yes, Your Honor, but I still believe that this case is different because I do not think that the trial record relied on that physical device in order to establish an element of criminality. I think in the Eighth Circuit case, there was, and again, I haven't reviewed the trial record of that, but it seems like there was reliance on physical devices being 6 or 7 of these cell phones to support that contention. Here, that statement by Officer Lee isn't in relation or wasn't discussed when the physical device itself was admitted into evidence. It was more regarding the videos in totality.
Thank you. I'm sorry, your time is up. Thank you. 15 minutes can go really fast when you're being peppered with questions. State.
May it please the court, my name is Joshua Llewellyn and I represent the state of Texas. If property seized pursuant to a valid search warrant has independent value as evidence of a crime at the time of its seizure, delay in the searching of the contents of that property cannot render the search unconstitutional. And this is because the delay is relevant only to the validity of the prolonged seizure and not the search of the device itself. I think because this is a new area of the law that...
Repeat what you just said.
Delay is relevant only to the validity of a prolonged seizure of a device and not to the search of the device itself.
Sure. So it doesn't make the search and seizure initially ineffective at all. It doesn't make it illegal at all.
Correct, Your Honor.
We're just looking at whether or not it's reasonable to be able to keep this device this long if they have a possessory interest in it.
Correct,
what,
Your Honor.
What determines independent value?
Independent evidentiary. So I think what determines independent evidentiary value is this piece of evidence something that we would actually be admitting as relevant evidence of guilt in a trial?
Just the fact that there was a DVR system in and of itself, regardless of what it showed?
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, we undoubtedly...
What would be the theory of admissibility of just the mere fact of cameras inside the residence?
So the theory of admissibility in this case would be that when a police officer is raiding a house suspected to be a trap house, or in other words, a house that is solely used for the purpose of dealing drugs and not as a residence, they look at several factors, and officers testified to this ad nauseum. For example, minimal furnishings, minimal personal items, no pictures on the walls, potentially gaming systems, minimal food in the pantry, cabinets and refrigerator, coverings over the windows, lots of short-term vehicle and foot traffic, and also having surveillance systems in order to alert that the people in the house to potential raids by police officers. And so...
Well, that wouldn't be internal. That would be the external cameras. So what we're dealing with here is the internal cameras. So are you saying that we can find that there's independent value because of the external cameras, and then the video from the internal cameras is just icing on the cake?
Maybe I don't understand the record and I missed something, but the exterior cameras were put up by the police, or did the DVR or the poll camera? Oh, but did this DVR system also have, was it also capturing external footage?
I will say the record is not entirely clear on that matter, only because the officers didn't testify specifically to the external cameras. But the pictures that were admitted into evidence shows that there was an external camera that was appeared to be disabled outside the house. And there were also two channels that were mentioned by the person who examined the actual DVR device. He was asked basically what videos were you asked to remove from the device. And he testified, well, I was asked to remove videos from this device that recorded on these two different channels, which it stands to reason there were at least two cameras. And if you also look at the one of the body camera footage videos that was admitted into evidence, when they're raiding the house underneath the little carport area, it looks like there was a mount for that camera that they probably disabled as they were going in so that the people inside could not be aware of their movements.
Okay, when did that evidence come in? It didn't come in during the suppression hearing. So did it come in as part of the reconsideration during trial?
All that evidence that I just referred to, like the videos and the pictures, that was just admitted as evidence trial and not necessarily as part of any hearing.
But that occurred before the trial court reconsidered his ruling with regard to the DVR? Or did he first make a ruling with regard to the DVR, because then you don't get the tech testifying as to what channels he took out of the DVR, because you're not supposed to know about it if it gets suppressed?
Right. The testimony of the tech who pulled out who pulled the videos out, that happened before they admitted the actual videos that were on the content of the device.
This is a good place for me to ask this question. When did the Michael Morton disclosures concerning the DVR occur?
Concerning the DVR?
In other words, the DVR is evidence. You know that it's going to want it, you know, you are fighting to have it available to put before the jury, at least at the hearing on the motion for suppression, okay? You have a duty under the Michael Morton Act, under 3914, to present to the defense every material bit of evidence, even if you don't intend to put it on at trial. So this makes it pretty clear this is material evidence. So when did that disclosure occur? And did that disclosure identify not only the DVR, but also the videos that have been extracted from it?
Your Honor, I don't think the record actually has any document that shows when any particular disclosure occurs. I could inform the court of the general policy of disclosure and discovery in Tarrant County, but that's not part of the record.
Well, but
so
we're dealing with a new issue, okay? And we're supposed to start from the seizure, which occurred when he got arrested, all right? But we're also supposed to be balancing stuff. And would we be able to consider the fact that the state had said, hey, we've got the DVR, we've extracted it based upon a search warrant that we obtained, and we presented that to counsel for the defendant several months before the motion for suppression occurred, and so in other words, the fact that the motion for suppression came substantially delayed in the prosecution would indicate there's not an assertion of possessory interest on the part of the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that could be a relevant consideration when determining the strength of the person's possessory interest in the item. But
that's not in the record.
It's not record, okay. And it
so,
really is.
Presumably the defendant was not challenging anything on Michael Morton grounds.
Correct. And it really is his burden to demonstrate his possessory interest in a case where there were warrants for the search and there's a warrant for the seizure. And so any deficiency in the record, I think, should really count against him.
The defendant have counsel when the search warrant was obtained to actually do the video dump? And did defendant get notice of that search?
I am not aware if he had counsel at that point or not. I imagine that he did because they typically get appointed counsel soon after their arrest when the case is filed. And the delay was about 149 days in between the day he was arrested and the day of the actual search of the device.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
If this was warrantless, obviously the burden would shift to the state. Correct.
The burden would shift to the state with regard to demonstrating the reasonableness of the search. I think the case law is pretty clear that the defendant still has the burden to show standing. So there's still that initial burden that he would have to shoulder.
And of course, the appellant in their brief pointed out that the standard review here is de novo, that we're supposed to apply a de novo standard. And I don't think you put that in your brief, but I'm assuming that's because you concede that that's correct.
Yes.
And so we really have to look at everything.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to factual findings, the court generally defers to the trial court's findings of fact. But as far as the legal issues, of course, this court reviews de novo.
Now, let's assume that that we agree with the defendant that that there was a possessory interest. He had standing, all this stuff. The state, the explanation given for the 149-day delay was, I would say, less than compelling. I mean, there really wasn't an excuse that I could see offered for why it took so long. Would you be encouraging us, assuming that that's all true, to say that a 149-day delay is reasonable?
I'm not prepared here to say that 149 days of delay is reasonable in a case, but the question of reasonableness, I think, is it's balancing all the factors, and delay is not the only factor. It's important to consider the fact that police may engage in unreasonable conduct in any number of ways. But it's only relevant in a Fourth Amendment analysis if the unreasonable police conduct actually violated someone's constitutional rights. And in this case, even if the court were to find that the 149 days was unreasonably long, that the detective should have gotten the warrant earlier, then, well, it shouldn't matter if that didn't result in the violation of someone's constitutional rights. And to that point, I think it's important to start with first principles, because there's a lot of confusion, I think, in this area of the law. And based on the text of the Constitution, there are two things that are protected. It's your right against unreasonable searches and your right against unreasonable seizures. The Supreme Court said in Jacobson, or United States versus Jacobson, that a search occurs when an expectation of privacy that society is prepared to consider reasonable is infringed. However, a seizure of property occurs when there is some meaningful interference with an individual's possessory interests in that property. And the appellant here, he's not challenging the initial seizure, and he's not challenging probable cause for the search or the warrant for the search. He is only challenging delay. One of the cases cited by the parties, United States versus Smith, it's a Second Circuit case, makes it clear that this issue of delay is only an issue of seizure. The court said, "We demand expediency in obtaining a search warrant to search seized evidence in order to avoid interfering with a continuing possessory interest for longer than reasonably necessary in case the search reveals no evidence or permissibly segregable evidence of a crime, and the item has no independent evidentiary value and is not otherwise forfeitable." As Justice Gorsuch of the Supreme Court, then judge on the Tenth Circuit, said in United States versus Christie, "What, after all, is reasonable about police seizing an individual's property on the ground that it potentially contains relevant evidence and then simply neglecting for months or years to search that property to determine whether it really does hold relevant evidence needed for trial or is totally irrelevant to the investigation and should be returned to its rightful owner?" So, in any case where you have a seizure, you're balancing the state's interest in the property against the possessory right of that person to that property. If I were to sum up this whole area of the law, I would say there comes a point where the Constitution does not tolerate continued seizure of a person's property based merely on probable cause that the property may contain evidence when a mere search of that property could confirm or dispel that notion. We just can't hold on to property without knowing whether it has evidentiary value or not.
Would you agree that if we were addressing Junior, that the state's case with regard to this would be toast? Because he was the target. You had evidence of him going in and out of the residence. Okay. His car was there. And so he's showing that he has some type of privacy interest in that residence. And if the 149 days occurred after he clearly was the target, under the circumstances, you'd have a violation here. Would you not agree?
I would not agree with that, Your Honor. And the reason is Junior would still have the burden to show that he has a cognizable Fourth Amendment interest in that device. When we're talking about a seizure, and I would respectfully disagree with the court's framing as far as reasonable expectation of privacy. And the reason is there's this threshold issue that the courts have to consider, that it's commonly called standing. But the Supreme Court has stated that standing is really just a term that people, that courts tend to use, but it's not a term of art. It's not Article III standing. It's not a jurisdictional issue. Really, when you're analyzing that, the question is whether a person has a cognizable Fourth Amendment interest in the property. And if it's a seizure, then the cognizable interest is, I own that property and I'm entitled to possess it. It's not, do I have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that matter? And I think
the evidence that I just elicited, discussed, would indicate that he has a possessory interest in that residence, which would include as an attachment to the residence, the DVR.
And to that, I would say, Your Honor, that past possession of an item or property does not equal either a property right in that item or even a possessory interest. I may go to a bank and borrow a pen to fill out a form. I had possession of that item, but I don't actually have a possessory interest in it. And I don't have any cognizable Fourth Amendment right in the thing. With regard to this house, the evidence suggests that this house was solely used for the purpose of dealing drugs. And there's no evidence as to who owned the house. There's no evidence as to who owned or purchased the DVR. The only evidence we have in the case about standing is that the appellant was at some time in the past considered to have been in constructive possession of it. There's no evidence that even Junior lived in that house. And for appellant, he stated to the police that he did not live in that residence. He made no claim of ownership, no claim of right to possess. He had no cognizable property interest in it. We don't even know if he knew the password to the DVR. It was password protected. I don't know that about Junior either. I would liken this case to a QT manager who's managing a business, because that's what this was. This is a place of business. It was not a residence. If you're a QT manager, you have possession of the surveillance equipment at QT, but you can't be said to have a possessory interest or a property right in that item once you're removed from that location. So you have a
burden to show that you have a cognizable personal interest in it, possessory interest.
Right. Right. And I would say the same thing about Junior. It's possible that Junior might have had some property right in the thing, but it's just,
we don't have it in this record.
We don't have it in the record.
And let me ask you a little bit different question here. So these cases that deal with the cell phones, for example, that have said that there's a too long of a search, or at least before you actually get the warrant, is excessive. It seems like the rationale that they use in that is it's there's important private information on those devices, right? That's what you see.
Right.
Are you aware in those cases, do they ever define private information?
I don't think there's really a definition that they provide, but I'll confess that I haven't thoroughly At least I don't recall thoroughly the analysis in those questions. It's just that for a phone, there's a strong possessory interest in the item because you have, you know, I think it's common sense. Nowadays, everybody has a smartphone. They put large amounts of personal information on it, and it's used in daily life all the time. And so, yeah, you're going to need possession of that thing. I think that's what they primarily rely upon.
Yeah, and there's no evidence in this record that the appellant desperately needed access to the DVR during the time that he was in jail.
No, Your Honor. And, you know, it's interesting, this balancing test, when you're talking about the possessory interest against the state's legitimate interest in the property. You balance that in any seizure case. Delay only becomes relevant when you're not sure whether or not this piece of evidence is actually evidence or is just a thing that you took. But if it is actual evidence of a crime, the seizure is justified for the entire duration of the seizure until you get to trial and the person gets acquitted or convicted, and then maybe you don't need it anymore after that point. But even if you have an actual interest in that property, your interest never becomes greater than the government's interest in that property for the pendency of the case, unless you have a situation like the State v. Beal case where you're actually saying, hey, I need that property because it's important for my defense.
So you're saying that as soon as you dumped the video and you figured out that it actually showed that they were cooking meth in the kitchen, that became evidence of a crime. And at that point in time, whether he had a possessory interest in it or not didn't matter, because it's that would be the independent value. But to get to the determination of an independent value, you had to actually dump the DVR.
I think that may be the case in most cases with cell phones. In this case, though, the DVR was independent evidence of the crime because it was evidence supporting the fact that it was a trap house. And the fact that it was a trap house was central to the state's case. In fact, Officer Lee expressly testified at the suppression hearing prior to trial that the DVR was considered evidence of the crime and it was relevant evidence of drug trafficking, even apart from its content. With that, we respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Before you just right out of the bag, let me just address the elephant in the room here. Do you concede that, you know, I mean, I think there's some confusion about why drug dealers would need video cameras inside their house. And the reason is because they have other people dealing drugs in that house, and they want to make sure that they're not getting cheated. They want to make sure that the people working in the house are not pocketing money that's supposed to go to the head of the operation. They're in that house because they want to make sure that people aren't stealing some of the contraband. Would you agree with that? I mean, that's why they have those in the house.
Yes, I think that is a theory for having surveillance videos in the house. And I think that's the state's theory here in this case. But I do still think that the nature of the surveillance footage, or the security footage inside the house, is a really important consideration in determining his possessory interest.
Well, at any point up until this became a problem, did your client ever ask or object or bring to the attention to the state that he wanted that information, that he wanted access to it?
Your Honor, it does not appear so. And he was incarcerated for the majority of that time. So his ability to get access to that, it was limited. However, the district court acknowledged on its own that Mr. Barnett's initial counsel was not the same counsel that was his trial counsel. And the district court acknowledged in considering that factor that when his trial counsel, who handled his trial, became his attorney, that attorney very quickly filed this motion to suppress. And the district court's consideration of that, I think, is very important in this analysis as well.
Let me run a hypothetical next to you, because this is my understanding of what the state's attorney is arguing. Let's say you've got an individual who is a cashier for 7-Eleven, and he knows that, in fact, 7-Eleven has cameras sitting looking at him dealing with the till, okay? And ultimately, the owner of the 7-Eleven determines that money is missing from the till, files a complaint. He's arrested and prosecuted for stealing money from the till, okay? But for whatever reason, the law enforcement and the prosecution don't actually dump the video from any of the camera, internal camera surveillance, until 149 days after it's actually, he's arrested and it's seized. Okay. My understanding from what he's arguing is that that doesn't matter. 149 days doesn't matter because it's evidence of the crime itself, i.e. taking money out of till, and therefore it doesn't matter. And we won't even get into whether or not the cashier would have a privacy interest at all with regard to a camera in a place he's working. But that's my understanding of his argument. So why is that? It's a similar, you know, I don't know that there's any evidence that your client actually knew he was being surveilled at the time that he was in. And I understand you're arguing that that really isn't for sure him in the video, but why would that not apply under these circumstances?
Your Honor, a couple things there. I think here the facts are very different, and this kind of more gets into that possessory interest. But additionally, I think to rely on that argument would then kind of negate this five-factor consideration fairly universally, because if we're talking a child pornography case, I think that argument could dangerously get stretched to any evidence of a crime found on a cell phone or a wireless communication device. And additionally, I think the consideration of the DVR in defendant's possessory interest, it's important to highlight the considerations of why courts have given this heightened protection to both homes and cell phones to protect a person's privacy interest in incredibly large amounts of very personal data. And that is precisely what this DVR was doing. It was recording people inside a private residence, not a public space, a private residence. And the record reflects that there were hundreds of videos. And while the officer did not review all hundreds, the several that he reviewed, several of those videos just detailed Mr. Burnett going about his daily life, didn't detail anything incriminatory. Lastly, I would just like to highlight that the circuit court's cases that are used by both Mr. Barnett and by the state deal with much smaller delays. Even finding unreasonable delays there, they typically deal with delays from 15 to 90 days. Based on that and the state's lack of explaining any due diligence in this delay, we ask that this court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank counsel for the argument. It's been very helpful to us. And you want to step out for a minute and then we'll come back in?
Sure.
Yeah. So we'll stand adjourned. Your case is submitted. We'll come back.